Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Now, as it happens, we're going to talk about grief now, but I think in a life-affirming way. I suppose everyone's grief is the same in one way, and then all our grief is different too. And sometimes writers are the best people to make sense of things. So I'm joined now by two writers, Kathy Kelly and Judith Cough. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
So, Judith, if we talk about your story first, and I'm conscious your grief is still very raw. So your dad passed away in December after a long illness, but then your brother died very suddenly 2 months later. You wrote a piece about this and you make that distinction between passing away and dying. So your dad passed away. He'd been sick. He was sent home from hospital to spend his last few days at home. I gather he beat the odds there, did he?
Yeah, he did. We brought him out of hospital with the odds of, listen, by the weekend, he'll, you know, might go asleep and it'll all come quiet. And he came back to life with a bang for 7 weeks and gave us an enormous gift in that time, actually, where we got to say goodbye, to spend time with him, to care for him. So it was, I suppose, when I made that distinction between passing away, it was coming. We knew it was coming. He knew it was coming. And if I can say, it was a nice time.
Yeah.
If you can say that.
No, I think everyone understands what you mean. Yeah.
And I think we got to say everything we wanted to say and leave nothing unsaid. So it was a good death as far as deaths go.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And a good death is so important, you realize. Yeah. And then the eulogy. So as the writer in the family, the eulogy fell to you.
I think they'd use the term the one fullest of hot air.
Yeah,
but yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So I started writing it in those weeks, when I had moments to myself. And I wasn't necessarily writing it as a eulogy. I was writing it because Dad was telling us a lot of stories during that time and I wanted to remember them myself. And I sort of had the idea that I would read to him what I had written about his life.
Yeah.
And
so he was putting things in order, was he himself?
Yeah,
as
he
well,
spoke a lot about his childhood.
Fixing his story.
Yeah, he spoke a lot about, he told loads of funny stories. Myself and my sister sat on the end of his bed with him every day. And, you know, so I wanted to kind of remember them. And then I suppose, even though I knew what was happening with Dad, I suppose there comes a time where you reach those final days. And it turned into a eulogy, I suppose, at that time. I realised that I would probably speak it at his funeral instead of telling him. Because obviously at that stage he had gone asleep for the last few days. So I wrote it and, you know, I know Kathy will agree, it's incredibly cathartic to write. Until it got to the day of the funeral, I was thinking to myself, will I be able to do this? But I suppose you're sort of in shock at a funeral as well.
Yeah.
So there's a level of shock going on there, and I suppose a sort of a game face. So I did it, and I was incredibly proud that I was able to.
You got through it.
To get through it,
I now know myself that there's a lot of politics in the family around eulogy. So the way it worked out, my dad died actually probably
the day after your dad died.
So basically. And look, I'm going to reopen old wounds here, but everybody knew what should be in the eulogy, but nobody wanted to give the eulogy. So I was like, well, you all know what it should be, so why don't you give it? So then I agreed to take the hit on the grounds that nobody was allowed to offer any opinions on the eulogy afterwards.
Yeah,
and actually, we stuck with that deal and they didn't, and it kind of worked out that way.
Yeah.
But it can be, it's quite another issue there in the middle of when everybody's trying to sort things out.
I think they were only too happy to hand it over to me, to be honest.
Rather let someone else do it and be able to say how they would have done it better.
Yeah.
So listen, and your brother John helped you. Kathy, I'll come to you in a minute. We'll just finish out with Judith here on her story. So your brother John, he was there helping you organise the funeral and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, with the two of us headed off, we had 2 or 3 days together, which in hindsight, you know, you look back on it now and it was an incredibly special time without knowing what was to come with John. With everything in life, we laughed through it, you know, almost laughing through the tears. Mm. And Yeah, so we organised Dad's funeral. I mean, to the point of Dad was a carpenter and a builder, and so was John. And I remember standing in the room of coffins, and Dad, you know, John knocked on one and said, you know, that's fit for purpose, Dad's term. You know, yeah. That'll do. That's yeah. one for Dad. He said, yeah. Now, if it was me, I'd go for the one over here. Which, you know, then what came afterwards, it was just so weird.
I presume you remember everything about the day John died,
yeah.
as against passed away.
Yeah. yeah.
Tell
everything.
Me about that day.
I was out walking and I was talking to a friend who was in a very similar place to where I had been with Dad weeks before. Her mum was dying, and she had reached that point where I think we all reach, where you wanted to be over. You wanted to be over for them, and it's an incredibly difficult time for the family. And I was talking her through it, and I walked up through Enniskerry. I stopped at the coffee shop, bought myself a coffee. My brother drove past me, 1 o'clock. I texted him. I said, come back and meet me for a coffee. He didn't answer. And which wasn't unusual. I was to meet him later that day, and my mum's, he'd been out for a cycle. And I got home and I got into the car to drop my daughter to a hockey match, got to the end of the road, and he called the phone. His phone called me back, but it was his wife saying that something was terribly wrong. So I was at the house moments after the ambulance. He'd gotten into the shower. He'd suffered a massive, we think, we still don't know, because obviously the autopsy results don't come back for 6 months, but we think a massive cardiac arrest or an aneurysm or something. And they worked on him for 2 hours in total in the house and in the hospital. But sadly, he didn't make it.
And super fit guy. And
super fit guy. He skied, he wakeboarded, he everything. He was just full of life and very, very unexpected and a huge. So I think that's the difference between yeah. passing away and that very sudden death.
I think the difference is shock too,
it's
isn't it?
Shocking. Shock. Is, yeah. Is, and I think we're still in that shock, you know. And I think yeah. it takes a couple of months for the veil to lift, as I call it. So it's nearly becoming very real now, in that, you know, we haven't seen him for that length of time that you're like, he's not on a holiday, you know.
Yeah.
But he was an incredible man, and he lived his life. You know, it's funny because, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, you didn't get to say all the things you wanted to say mm. to him, whereas we did with Dad. But if I can kind of sum it up with John, because we had spent so much time together as a family, we'd had those moments, and I like to think that John had said everything he would have said to me
yeah.
in those weeks prior to his death, from I'm proud of you, I love you, the real Irish brother, you know, yeah. here's a few bob for yeah. yourself. And what he said to me when I was talking at Dad's funeral and I paused, he said, keep going, Judy. And I literally hold on to that every single day. That is what is driving me forward, and for his wife and his girls, and I suppose taking that love and putting that into them.
Yeah.
Is the goal.
And
the
isn't it great the comfort we can take from the stories that and the narratives people can put, and the way you're able to have that story for yourself, that
yeah.
actually you had that time with John
yeah.
in a different way to with
yeah.
your dad. Cathy, the grief that I want to talk to you about is a very different one. You've also had a bit more time to reflect on it, but I think it's a thing that people will go, yes, yes, of course. The grief for a friend, because like for a lot of us, friends are as important, maybe more intimate part of our lives than family. So the author Emma Hannigan, and people will remember Emma, who kind of famously yeah. battled cancer. Was it 10 times?
11 times.
11 times. Extraordinary. Ye became best friends as adults, which is kind of slightly unusual, isn't it?
I don't know, actually. I think maybe it's a writery thing, but you... I've made quite a lot of wonderful friends as a writer, because you're doing this really intense job and you meet people on a very intense level. That's going to sound completely weird, but when I met Emma, she'd been diagnosed with the BRCA1 gene, the Ashkenazi Jewish breast cancer and ovarian cancer gene, and she was just about to start the surgery. So she was going to have her breasts removed and her ovaries removed, and she was the youngest person ever to have this done in Ireland, and she had quite a fight to get it done. And she said she always wanted to write. And I said, well, I'm there. I'll help you, you know. And we became so incredibly close. And I was saying, I mean, we would talk on the phone 3 times a day. Literally, it was incredible. But when I think what Judith is talking about, that being able to, that precious time you had with your dad, mm-hmm. that allowed you and John to say all the things. And I think being open to death in the sense that we are all going to die. And it's, I think it's very hard for our brains to get around this as a concept. But because you had that time with your dad, you and John said the things you need to say. And Emma was an incredibly wise person, and she wasn't afraid to talk about death. She wasn't afraid to talk about cancer. Her memoir, Talk to the Headscarf, she writes, and only someone with cancer could write this, you know, when you get a cancer diagnosis, do not go out into the back garden and dig a grave. So she was very aware of how close death was. So there were no unsaid things. So when she died, there was massive grief. And I always say that for her family, they're the people who, you know, her Kim and Sasha and her husband Keane and Philip and Denise and her cousins Steffi and Robin, they're the people who are allowed most grief.
Of course.
But she was like my sister.
You see, do the friends sometimes feel a bit like imposters, or, you know,
Totally.
Don't want to be there being chief mourner, but actually it's a huge loss for people who are kind of sitting down the back of the church a lot and kind of standing back and letting the real grievers have their time. But actually, it's devastating for them sometimes.
I was a real I'll stand down the back of the church thing, but she was just such a huge part of my life, and it was completely devastating. Her funeral, I just sobbed. And the loss of her, she was just such a massive part of my life. She was like a sister, and I have a very beautiful sister, Lucy, and not taking away from that amazing friendship. But Emma was like another sister, and the loss was savage. And towards the end, like, all the time she would be going through various treatments, or she'd have to go in and have another scan, and we'd all be there on tenterhooks waiting, and then she'd come through it. But at the very end, when we all knew that she was not going to come out of it, that was devastating. But I think what lifted it was her, and she was an amazing human being. And in the last,
and she passed away in the best sense of things, really, didn't she?
She did.
There was a process there she managed almost.
She managed it. She didn't want her family to, of course they were going to be devastated, but she wanted to write her eulogy. She organised her funeral. She raised €130,000 in the last week of her death for Breast Cancer Ireland, which is an amazing organisation. She was an ambassador for Breast Cancer Ireland. But she did everything she could to make it as easy as possible, and yet there's still that enormous gap from this phenomenal human being. I talk to her now, in the way that you do. It's like this voice in your head that you can talk to and go, God, what would you do? You know, what do you think? Because she was a very strong person, and she was very inspirational in so many ways. And I can be an
what it sounds like from what you're saying, right, is that because death was a real thing for her, possibly, as you say, unlike the rest of us in our various layers of delusion, she obviously had no time for bull. Because you get this clarity, don't you? If you think, okay, we're here, we're going to be gone, so there's no time for messing around or bull.
Precisely.
Or anything.
So she'd no time, but she was a very clear person anyway, in every part of her life. She called a spade a spade. So, you know, with this reality, there was no time for the bull, as you say. She was just totally straight, you know, let's deal with this. Let's deal with everything. Let's get it up on the table, which is how it was such an amazing friendship, because all the extraneous rubbish was removed. It was just a pure, real friendship, like a vein, like into my veins, into her veins. The grief is absolutely horrendous. I think that the hard thing is knowing you won't see the person again. I think that's, as humans, we find that hard. It's like our vision of the universe. We can't imagine the universe. It's too big. We can't imagine not seeing people again. That's just too big for us.
Like you, Judith, there's an element of the magical thinking if you're still waiting for John to come back from wherever he is.
A little bit,
That kind of hierarchy that we're referring to there, a hierarchy of grief, if you will, I suppose, is there a sense of that with John as well, that like you have to stand back slightly and go, his partner and his kids are.
Yeah, and it's funny from what Cathy was saying there, we talk about this a lot. I kind of call it the food pyramid of grief, you know, they're the sweet treats and I'm a lean protein, if I can put it that way. No, do you know what? His wife is an incredible person, and she is incredibly, you know, she recognises our grief as well. And I think we're all in it together.
And his friends, I mean, you know, you really reap what you sow in life. And that's so evident now. His friends have been incredible to us, like absolutely outstanding.
So this has brought everyone together, has it? Because I think sometimes these things can go either way in a family.
It has. Like, you know what? There's times, like, I have two sisters as well. And we are in exactly the same position. The three of us, we both lost a father and a brother. And it can be difficult because sometimes you're comforting each other and you're nearly saying to them what you need them to say to you, you know, and you're thinking, I actually nearly don't feel this, but I have to try and comfort someone else. But, you know, I think grief is grief. And if you feel it, I mean, John was a local Enniskerry, as I am, as Cathy is. And, you know, people are still coming up to me in the street saying it has affected me hugely, his loss, because it's out of the ordinary. And it makes you think about life and what's left and what you want to do. And, you know, so it changes people. Even if you weren't in that very top level of grief, it changes your world.
Yeah, it's the time. Right. I think it's the length of time someone has lived. I think that is the difference. So your dad, and, you know, OK, who am I to say what age is the right age to go?
But
your dad was sick and he was older and he'd lived his life. But when it's a child, or when it's someone who's got a 7-year-old little girl and an 11-year-old little girl.
Out of order.
I think the age makes such a difference, you know.
But then, Cathy, so your dad, in a sense, passed away, but it's still quite young, and it was a long process, but I'd say very hard for him and everyone, was it?
Yeah, my father got early onset dementia in his 50s. So I am now in my 50s. So, yeah, scary. I'm hands up for euthanasia here. But he was nearly 61 when he died, and it was completely horrendous. So I think a lot of people who've had parents die with dementia say that they've said goodbye long before the person is actually gone, because they no longer know who you are. All these things are slowly stripped away to the point that this is a person, and you know that somewhere in there, hopefully, is that person. And you hate them going through pain, which is why I am a fan of euthanasia.
And look, a lot of people will disagree with you, obviously. And that conversation is coming down.
I know that's another conversation. But I think if you've seen someone go through it, I think you might. That's where it's informed from me.
Yeah. And it was painful for him as well as for everyone.
Yes, it was. Because I used to just look into his eyes and he just looked so lost. And it's just horrendous. It is a horrendous thing.
But sometimes afraid, you see in
yes, it's
eyes,
fear.
They're afraid.
Yeah,
all the time.
It's that fear. And there is a period, I think, with people with dementia when there's great cognitive ability, and yet they're losing their cognitive ability. And it's that Iris Murdoch sailing into the dark thing. That must be beyond terrifying. And so anyway, near the end, I mean, my father, there was a nurse in the beautiful nursing home he was in. And my mother always said that she looked a bit like me, and he loved her. He loved her, but he didn't know who I was, but he sort of recognized her in some way. And that was lovely. So I think we'd all said goodbye, and we laughed a lot, not in sort of a slightly weird way when my father died, because he was out of that pain and
a release almost.
And we'd said goodbye, you know.
Cathy, being a bit further away from that and from Emma's death and everything, what would you say to Judith and to other people about time?
Oh, gosh, who am I to be telling Judith in a way? But I suppose time does make a difference. When Emma died first, I thought, how am I going to cope with this? I mean, and I've had depression on and off my whole life, and I was terrified I was going to fall into some hole of depression. And I thought, how am I going to cope with this horrible pain and loss? And I think you just do. You just get through this week and you get through the next week. And I think what is helpful is to remember the fun bits, because people run away from you. I think people run away because they're terrified of saying the wrong thing. But when you have people who remember the fun stuff, do you remember the mad time John did that thing and we all laughed? That actually is fabulous, because it's bringing them alive. It's talking about them. So I think, time, crazy though it is, does make a difference. And interestingly, I was reading about poor Annie McCarrick's mom in the papers, and she talks about the loss of her daughter, and she said, you know, time makes a difference. And I think the loss of a child, I just think that's the most horrendous loss. But time, I think we become accustomed, humans become accustomed. I don't know how well one ever becomes, could become accustomed to the loss of a child. But
Margaret Atwood said to me a few weeks ago that grief is not a tunnel because there's no end.
Yes.
She said it's like the moon. I thought it was lovely. She said it's like the moon. It's always there, but it waxes and wanes.
Yeah.
And you see more of it sometimes and you see less of it another time. Isn't that
so
fantastic?
Wise, that woman. Yeah. I love her.
Listen, Judith, in terms of what Cathy's saying there about people not knowing what to say, are people running away from you right now?
Yeah, you get the odd shoulder turner, you know, but you know, as I say, like we're bereaved, not blind, but but look, you know what? People have said weird things, of course. In the past, I have said weird things to people before I knew grief. You know, you try to kind of brush over it, or you try to find a silver lining in there. And there are no words. And I think that is the lovely. And I even got a text from Cathy the other day who said, there are no words. And I said, like, that's the perfect thing to say because there are none. But I do get great comfort from people who have come through the other side. And I do see people, you know, I have a friend who lost her husband 3 years ago. And she said to me, I am happy. I am happy after 3 years. It's not the same happy, but I'm happy.
Okay.
And I really hold on to that. So positivity goes a huge way. And like Cathy said, remembering funny stories. Like someone said to me the other day, wow, you sounded so like John when you said that there. Yeah. And it was gorgeous, you know. And
I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about the person.
Yeah.
But like, that's like that people telling or remembering the person, even like people you didn't know knew them or whatever, remembering the person
it's
and telling
lovely.
A story about
it's
them.
Huge.
That,
yeah.
That's what if people don't know what to say, that's one easy thing to do is say something about the person.
And I
it?
Suppose to say, you know, the things of, well, at least, you know, at least nothing.
At least. Nothing. Yeah.
Well, at least.
Yeah. Look, like, at least he didn't know he went fast.
You know, it was better for him, you know, or he's in a happier place. And you're like, nah, he's not actually, because he was really happy.
Yeah,
but look, it all comes from a place of well-meaning. And I think there isn't one person, even if they've said the most awkward thing, who I've thought, I wish you hadn't come up to me to express your condolences. Everybody, I feel it. And it's lovely. And especially to John's wife, people have been just outstanding. It really helps you see as well that there is lovely people out there and really generous, kind people. And it also puts, you know, as Cathy said, I can't see next year, but I can see the end of today. And it is a day at a time situation. And that's literally what we are doing at the moment. It's like, let's live in, and it kind of makes you live in the present a little bit more. You're like, right, what's today about? Which I am notoriously bad at before because I'm an impatient person, you know. So when people say time, I'm like, really? How long?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I know.
But I guess I've just got to slow into the moment and face it. There's no other way. I have a psychologist pal who said to me, I said, what's the best advice you can give me? Like, tell me how to do this. And she said, fall apart. Just fall apart and then rebuild.
Yeah. Have you fallen apart?
I've had my moments.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, some people will fall apart and some people will not fall apart. Everyone does grief
and it doesn't,
differently.
And it doesn't mean that they're not feeling it as hard. You know, you get that thing. I have heard a lot. And it is a great compliment. You know, you're strong. And you think, well, I actually don't really want to be strong. It's involuntary strength. But as I say to my sister-in-law Kira all the time, look, we're doing it. We're doing every day and we're here. And, you know, what if the thread breaks? What if the thread doesn't break? Like, what if we manage to hold things together as best as we can?
I think a lot of people, if they find a role in a situation at times like that, with grief or when something terrible happens, if they can find a role that actually keeps them taking one step in front of another.
You're there. You're there for your sister-in-law. You're there for your sisters. You're there for your nieces. You're there for your own children who are going through this grief.
Exactly.
And the fear. I think children are terrified when one parent dies. It's like, are you going to, something going to happen to you?
Okay.
So you're there. You can be there for them. And that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, it's outside of the purview of the conversation today in a way. But like, you are well aware, Judith, that you're also experiencing something else on top of grief, which is shock. And
absolutely.
I always think everybody will know grief. I think only about half the world knows real shock. And like you talk about, grief changes you, shock changes you, for better and worse, I think, in lots of ways. You're off to a concert tomorrow, Judith.
I am. I'm going to drop it like it's hot.
In honour of John.
So Snoop is literally the soundtrack of his life. Like,
oh, Snoop.
Snoop, yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. Gold bikini. and maybe a thigh boot. Look, who knows? Okay. It's lucky we're on radio.
We want visuals.
It was soundtrack of his life. So it's a, how can I describe it? It's going to be a bittersweet day, I think. But there's 9 of us going, his wife. It was also her birthday yesterday. And so this is sort of feels like a mini celebration of his life. So we're going to do, I mean, if I do drop it like it's hot, I may not get back up again.
Nah, you will. You will. Yeah, you're getting back up. I think you're getting back up every day. I think everybody can hear it. Yeah. Did you want to say something, Kathy?
No, yeah, I was saying just that, yes, you are. You are amazing. You're so doing much. It. Thank and you're doing you. It for everyone in his life. So.
So look, on what we're saying, it's different for everyone, right? Texter here. My father died 10 years ago. He was in his 70s, right? He was such a loving man, still leaves a huge void. Our large family have never recovered as a unit at the time of his death. Each of us dealt with his passing differently. It shone a spotlight in our different personalities. We've never been the same, which is a shame, but his passing made me very selective on who I spend my time with. There you go. Shock and grief, very, very clarifying. Hi, Brendan. I lost my parents, brother, sister and husband in the last 10 years.
Oh.
It's hard, but you eventually go back to normal. Texter says, my sister died suddenly on New Year's Day. The grief is overwhelming every day. I can imagine Texter overwhelming and there's nothing but to go through it. It's like the going on a bear hunt. You can't go over it. You can't go under it, can you? And look, we'll end on a light note. A great quote from Seinfeld regarding eulogies from this Texter. According to most studies, people's number one fear is public speaking. Number two is death. Death is number two. This means to the average person, if you have to go to a funeral, you're better off in a casket than during the eulogy.
That's a wonderful line.
Wow.
Judith Cuff and Kathy Kelly, thank you both very much. And Kathy, your latest book, The Wedding Party, is out now in paperback. I know you're off on a top secret visit with UNICEF as well that you can't talk about today. So good luck with that. And Judith, enjoy Snoop.
Thank you.